And like I said earlier, what Israel's been trying to do to limit the loss of life by SMSing civilians and WhatsApping and phoning and dropping pamphlets, that's again, if they wanted to commit genocide, they could just carpet bomb the whole Gaza and be done with it in a few minutes.
Israel versuche, den Verlust von Menschenleben in Gaza zu begrenzen, meint Daniel Bloch, Executive Director des Cape South African Jewish Board of Deputies. Ich habe ihn in seinem Büro in Kapstadt besucht. Er erzählt mir, dass am 7. Oktober eine Schockwelle durch Südafrika ging und erklärt, warum sein Heimatland eine der israelfeindlichsten Regierungen überhaupt habe und dass Israel ein Recht auf Selbstverteidigung habe. Herzlich willkommen zu einer neuen Folge des Zenit-Podcasts. Mein Name ist Josephine Herrmann. Heute sprechen wir über den Krieg in Gaza und über den IGH-Fall. Südafrika beschuldigt Israel, in Gaza einen Genozid zu verüben und hat das Land vor dem Internationalen Gerichtshof verklagt. Nur, wie kommt es dazu, dass ausgerechnet Südafrika Israel so in den Blick nimmt? Was hat Südafrika mit Gaza zu tun? Was mit den Palästinensern? Die historischen Beziehungen zwischen Israel und Südafrika waren vor allem während der Zeit des Apartheid-Regimes in Südafrika eng. Israel unterhielt Handels- und Militärbeziehungen zu Südafrika. Diese Verbindungen waren aufgrund der internationalen Isolierung Südafrikas während der Apartheid oft umstritten. Einige Kritiker verglichen die Politik der Rassentrennung in Südafrika mit Israels Besatzungspolitik in den besetzten palästinensischen Gebieten. Und sie betrachteten die Zusammenarbeit zwischen den beiden Ländern als Unterstützung für Unterdrückungssysteme. Die Regierungspartei ANC, der African National Congress, hat schon während des Widerstands enge Beziehungen zur palästinensischen Befreiungsorganisation, der PLO, unterhalten. Darüber hinaus wurde das damalige Apartheid-Regime Südafrikas von Israel unterstützt. Diese historischen Verbindungen haben dazu geführt, dass Südafrika eine aktive Rolle in der Unterstützung der palästinensischen Sache und der Verurteilung von Israels Aktionen im Gazastreifen einnimmt. Aber welche Rolle spielt eigentlich der Islam in Südafrika? Als die ersten muslimischen Sklaven und politischen Gefangenen im 17. Jahrhundert von niederländischen Siedlern aus verschiedenen Teilen der Welt ins Land gebracht wurden, darunter auch aus dem heutigen Indien, Indonesien und Malaysia, kam auch der Islam nach Südafrika. Ab 1860 waren unter den muslimischen Einwanderern auch Plantagenarbeiter und Kaufleute aus Indien. Sie brachten ihre Religion und Kultur mit nach Südafrika, beeinflussten damit die südafrikanische Gesellschaft und trugen dazu bei, den Islam im Land zu verbreiten und zu festigen. Im südlichsten Land des afrikanischen Kontinents leben rund 60,4 Millionen Menschen. Südafrika ist zu 85% christlich geprägt. Gerade mal 0,08% der Gesamtbevölkerung sind Juden. Die muslimische Bevölkerung macht heute etwa knapp 1,6% aus. In Bezug auf den Gaza-Konflikt zeigen Muslime in Südafrika oft eine starke Solidarität mit den Palästinensern. Ich war selbst in Südafrika unterwegs und habe in Kapstadt mit Menschen gesprochen, die sich pro-palästinensisch äußern oder Initiative für Israel ergreifen. Ich möchte verstehen, wie einflussreiche Stimmen im Land denken und was sie bewegt. Südafrika mag ein besonderer Fall sein, spielt aber als Teil des globalen Südens eine große Rolle. Wir probieren in diesen Folgen übrigens etwas Neues. Die Interviews habe ich auf Englisch geführt und werde sie euch im Original vorspielen. Dabei geht es mir darum, die Gäste aussprechen zu lassen und ihnen Raum zu geben. Anschließend fasse ich für euch zusammen. In dieser Folge spreche ich mit Daniel Bloch, Executive Director of the Cape South African Jewish Board of Deputies. Es ist die größte jüdische Organisation Südafrikas. Ich treffe Daniel Bloch in seinem Büro im Stadtteil Gardens in Kapstadt. Vor dem Gebäude patrouilliert die Armee. Auf der anderen Straßenseite befindet sich das Cape Town Holocaust and Genocide Center, das South African Jewish Museum und die Great Synagogue mit der ältesten jüdischen Gemeinde Südafrikas, die auf das Jahr 1841 zurückgeht. Im Gespräch erklärt Daniel mir, wie er die Klage Südafrikas bewertet und was ihn daran positiv stimmt. Und er pocht auf Israels Selbstverteidigungsrecht.
So if someone is threatened to kill your loved ones and repeatedly do that, you're not simply going to sit back and say, okay, we'll wait for the next attack. Israel has a right to defend itself.
Zum Hintergrund, Auslöser des Gaza-Kriegs war das Massaker, das Terroristen der Hamas und anderer extremistischer Palästinenserorganisationen am 7. Oktober in Israel nahe der Grenze zum Gazastreifen verübten. Nach israelischen Angaben wurden dabei etwa 1160 Menschen getötet und rund 250 weitere als Geiseln in den Gazastreifen verschleppt. Israel geht seitdem massiv militärisch im Gazastreifen vor. Angesichts der hohen Zahl ziviler Opfer und der katastrophalen humanitären Lage steht Israel international immer stärker in der Kritik. Bislang wurden nach Angaben des von der Hamas kontrollierten Gesundheitsministeriums mehr als 31.800 Palästinenser getötet. Von Daniel will ich wissen, wie Juden im ganzen Land auf das Massaker der Hamas auf Israelis am 7. Oktober reagiert haben.
So I think pretty much it was felt all around the world. I think our community, like everyone else, went through a range of emotions. Shock at what had happened, anger obviously at what had happened. For many in the South African Jewish community, we have family and friends that live in Israel. We know people that were murdered on the October 7th attacks, people that were called up, people that were affected by the rocket fire, by the terrorist attacks. So it was really a culmination of shock and horror, and upset also that our government didn't come out and condemn the attacks straight away. It took our government a couple of days to condemn what had happened. And naturally, being on a Saturday, on the Sabbath, a lot of our community only found out the Saturday evening after they switched their phones on and they turned the TV on. So it obviously took everybody by surprise.
And what would you say, what changed immediately for the Jewish community in South Africa?
The change is probably a little bit on edge, because now, even though the attack took place in Israel, we normally say when Israel sneezes, the diaspora Jewish community gets a cold. And naturally, when something of that magnitude happened in Israel, it sends shockwaves through South Africa. Now, we probably have one of the most anti-Israel environments in South Africa, with our government being anti-Israel, and the BDS movement is quite prevalent in South Africa, and especially in Cape Town, we feel it even more. So the minute these attacks happened, naturally the anti-Israel movements were celebrating and lauding the efforts of Hamas. And as a South African citizen and as a Jew, to see that immediately flashbacks of the 1930s and 40s with the Holocaust and Nazi Germany, you know, ran through everybody's mind. So what changed is we went from, you know, you could feel that sense of being safe normally to suddenly being on high alert and being on edge and having to prepare, well, could this take place on our doorstep? And having to make preparations around that.
Ich übersetze mal kurz das Sprichwort, was Daniel benutzt hat. Er sagte, wenn Israel niest, bekommt die jüdische Diaspora-Gemeinschaft einen Schnupfen. Und als etwas von diesem Ausmaß in Israel geschah, ging eine Schockwelle durch Südafrika. Südafrika habe eine der israelfeindlichsten Regierungen überhaupt. Und die BDS-Bewegung ist in Südafrika und vor allem in Kapstadt sehr weit verbreitet. BDS steht für Boykott, Desinvestition und Sanktionsbewegung. Sie setzt sich dafür ein, die internationale Unterstützung für die Unterdrückung der Palästinenser durch Israel zu beenden und Druck auf Israel auszuüben. You just said you felt it in Cape Town even more. Why is that?
So the BDS movement, even before October the 7th, have been quite prominent in Cape Town. They've protested outside our Jewish schools, outside our Jewish community center here in Gardens, which has the Jewish Museum, the Holocaust and Genocide Center, and a number of Jewish businesses, all in the guise of being pro-Palestinian. So there's been regular protests in Sea Point along the promenade on the beachfront, where they say they're coming to occupy the Zionist space, but what they really mean is they're coming to intimidate the Jewish community that lives in the Sea Point area. Because in Sea Point is probably home to a large component of the Jewish community in Cape Town. There's about 12,500 Jews in Cape Town, 13,000 maybe. And a large quantity lives in the Atlantic seaboard or the Sea Point area. So we've been feeling it for a number of years now. October the 7th just amplified things.
In Kapstadt leben ca. 12.000 Juden, vor allem in den Stadtteilen Seapoint und Atlantic Seaboard. Die BDS-Bewegung war in der Stadt schon vor dem 7. Oktober sehr präsent. Der 7. Oktober hat die Dinge nur noch verstärkt. Es gebe regelmäßig Proteste. Daniel meint, dass sie kommen, um die jüdische Gemeinde einzuschüchtern. Was sich belegen lässt, ist, dass Antisemitismus in Südafrika stark zugenommen hat. And to take a broader look. Antisemitism in South Africa between October and December 2023 increased by 631% compared to the same period last year.
Yeah, but if I can define that, so I think yes. One thing we need to understand about South Africa is compared with the rest of the world, I know the UK released figures for 2023, it was about 4,500 anti-Semitic incidents. The US, countries like the US, Germany, France, the UK, Australia, they're recording the highest number of anti-Semitic incidents in their history. And there's quite a lot of violence, assaults on Jewish individuals. Whereas in South Africa, in 2022, we had about 73 cases. And they were basically graffiti and a lot of online. In 2023, up until October the 7th, we were on about 63 plus minus was the number. So actually, we were thinking, wow, is it going to be lower than the previous year? And then between October and December, I think it was several hundred that were registered. But again, six cases of assault, physical assault, so someone being beaten up, not mugged and their wallet being stolen, but being beaten up, clearly Jewish individuals. And the rest was graffiti and a lot online, a lot of social media. And we don't take into account someone posting Free Palestine. That's not hate speech. But when they make references to Hitler and the Nazis, the Holocaust, obviously references to Judaism, Jewish power and supremacy, obviously that's counts as anti-Semitism. So South Africa, whilst we have a very aggressive anti-Israel movement here and our government is anti-Israel, anti-Semitism is still one of the lowest rates you'll find anywhere in the world, as being in Cape Town and Johannesburg. And our Jewish way of life is still protected. So members of our community can practice the religion free from discrimination. Unlike when you see in places like Berlin, you know, Israelis were beaten up for speaking Hebrew. When I was in Berlin last year in July, I was told stories by the community about how they hide their Star of David, their Magen David chains under their shirts. The religious Jews put a peak cap over their head to cover their kippah. We are not in that position at the moment. We're fortunately, our religious community members, the Rabbonim, they can walk around clearly identifying as Jews and not be intimidated in that regard and feel relatively comfortable. It's not to say we're not vigilant, and it's not to say we're naive to think it can't happen here, but fortunately, we've been protected.
Daniel setzt die Zahlen nochmal ins Verhältnis. Im Jahr 2022 gab es in Südafrika etwa 73 antisemitische Vorfälle. Dabei ging es im Wesentlichen um Graffiti und verbale Angriffe online. Im Jahr 2023, bis zum 7. Oktober, registrierte man 63 Vorfälle, plus minus. Und dann, zwischen Oktober und Dezember, stieg die Zahl antisemitischer Vorfälle an. Es waren mehrere hundert, die registriert wurden. Davon gab es 6 Fälle von Körperverletzungen, der Rest war Graffiti. Und dann gab es viel Hate Speech in den sozialen Medien. Wobei Daniel betont, dass Sprüche wie Free Palestine nicht darunter fallen. Aber wenn man sich auf Hitler und die Nazis beziehe oder auf den Holocaust, dann sind das natürlich Verweise auf das Judentum, auf jüdische Macht und Vorherrschaft. Und das zähle zu Antisemitismus, sagt Daniel. Und er sagt, obwohl man in Südafrika eine sehr aggressive Anti-Israel-Bewegung habe und die Regierung israelfeindlich sei, der Antisemitismus in Südafrika sei immer noch einer der niedrigsten in der Welt. Israel's ground offensive started just a couple weeks after October 7th. The IDF destroyed tunnels in Gaza, Hamas operatives surrendered, but Palestinian civilians died too, right? According to the health ministry in Gaza, which is controlled by Hamas, over 30,000 people have died so far. What do you think about that?
But interestingly enough, the day the ICJ, the International Court of Justice, gave their ruling on the genocide case, Hamas had stated about 31,000 civilians. They didn't even include the Hamas fighters, which there were several thousand. It was just purely 31,000. Amazing. If you look at their numbers, it's all women and children. No men, no terrorists or military personnel. And the ICJ gave a number of about 23,000. Now, I think it's important, regardless of whether it's one civilian or 20 or 30,000, the loss of any civilian life in any instance is tragic. And the Jewish community in South Africa, the South African Jewish Board of Deputies, we condemn all the loss of life, all loss of life. Mm. I think that's important. You know, as a Jewish community, we don't go out advocating for the death and the murder of anyone. When you see the anti-Israel movement standing outside a synagogue and a school screaming death to Israel, death to Zionists, one Zionist, one bullet, and they're on social media saying we should bomb this place and bomb this place and take action, you don't see the Jewish community and you don't see the pro-Israel community, even the Christian Zionists. It's all about peace and an end to the bloodshed, and a loss of life is tragic. Mm. So I think that's important that the numbers, whilst the numbers may be high, I think it's extremely unfortunate and it's sad that innocent civilians are paying the price for the war.
Also, Unabhängig davon, ob es sich um 20.000 oder 30.000 Tote handelt, der Tod von Zivilisten ist in jedem Fall tragisch. Daniel sagt, man verurteile jeden Verlust von Leben und sagt, die jüdische Gemeinschaft befürworte Ermordung natürlich grundsätzlich nicht. Man sei nicht wie die Anti-Israel-Bewegung, die vor einer Synagoge oder einer Schule steht und schreit, Tod für Israel, Tod den Zionisten. Trotzdem, der internationale Druck auf Israel steigt, eine Militäroperation in Rafah, an der südlichen Grenze Gazas, eine Grenze zu Ägypten, zu unterlassen. Aber wir hören auch, dass die Bemühungen zu einem zumindest vorübergehenden Waffenstillstand immer intensiver werden. Countries like South Africa or Turkey or Malaysia, they are saying that the response to the Hamas's attack on October 7th has gone too far and the international pressure on Israel is increasing. You know, to refrain from a military operation in Rafah on the southern border. But we are also hearing that the efforts to achieve a temporary ceasefire are also intensifying. So what do you think? What is going to happen next?
So it's a tough question. So just to clarify, so if I go back, the South African Jewish Board of Deputies, our mandate is to protect the civil rights of the Jewish community in South Africa. And obviously in my role, we look at the Western Cape. So there's 50,000 Jews in South Africa, it's about 13,000 in the Cape, Western Cape. And we don't necessarily advocate for Israel, but we advocate when it impedes Jewish way of life. And it's every Jewish person's right to practice their religion. Israel forms part of Judaism. Zionism is part of Judaism. You can't split the two, just to make that clear. In terms of your question, I think it's important, again, to look at facts. So, you know, Hamas came out on live international TV saying Al-Aqsa flood 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, Al-Aqsa 1 million. They have promised to do Al-Aqsa time and time again. So if someone has threatened to kill your loved ones and repeatedly do that, you're not simply going to sit back and say, okay, we'll wait for the next attack. Israel has a right to defend itself as a state, as a nation. It's received this threat from Hamas. 1,200 innocent civilians were murdered and butchered, burnt, raped. The list can go on. And Israel has decided it will not allow this to happen again. So it is justified in its defense. Unfortunately, from what we've seen, and you mentioned before we started talking, Hamas has over 450 miles or kilometers of underground tunnels. It's longer than the UK underground. They have also said on TV, and this is the incredible thing, that Hamas tells us everything on TV and on all of their websites and social media posts. So this is factual information. Hamas has said those tunnels are built for Hamas fighters, not for the civilians. They've said on live TV, protection of the Palestinian civilians is not their priority. It's not their responsibility. Now, as the ruling governing party and authority of the area, can you imagine if the German government or the British government or the South African government came out saying, it's not our policy, it's not our obligation to protect its civilians? Well, you've been... But I think the difference is those governments were voted into power. Hamas created a coup in 2006. So they were never voted in by the Palestinian people. So I think what Israel's doing, yes, there's a loss of life. And there's a huge amount of loss of life. But we also have to look at Hamas's tactics, using civilians as shields. I mean, all of those, I'm not going to go into those details because I think the tunnels and human shields and the videos, and they've all been displayed and showcased for the whole world to see. And when you are a terrorist organization embedding yourself in civilian populations, inside the schools and the mosques and the hospitals, you know, Israel's got two choices. Do they sit back and go, right, well, we can't take any action because Hamas is using civilians as shields, but then allow Hamas to restock, replenish, and then just come with another barrage of rockets and gunfire? Or they're going in and they are trying to rid the area of Hamas. Now, we've also seen that it was evident from the ICJ case. You know, everyone's on the other side is celebrating what a victory, but it wasn't a victory. South Africa went into the ICJ case asking for one, I know there were 9 provisional measures, but one was the main priority, was the end to military excursions in Gaza by Israel. And all of the judges were unanimous. Firstly, they came out saying they're not going to give a decision on genocide because that's not the purpose of the ruling. Mm. So Israel hasn't been found guilty of genocide or anything of that nature. And none of them agreed to a ceasefire or the cessation of military action. Why? Because they believe in Israel's right to defend itself. In fact, the ICJ put in a condition which South Africa didn't even ask for, which was the unconditional release of the hostages, which, funny enough, we haven't seen anything. Now, unconditional doesn't mean that Hamas gets to ask for 4,000 criminal and terrorists to be released in exchange for 136 hostages. So I think, going back to your question, Israel is trying, and they've proven in the ICJ, that they have tried to limit the loss of life. I think if you've seen in any war, where in recent history does a military give a warning? I mean, they gave Gazans 3 weeks to evacuate before they did their ground incursions into Gaza. And I think an interesting thing has come up. We need to have more interviews with military experts, because we had a speaker down here the other day, Daniel Taub, a former Israeli ambassador to the UK. And he made this point. He said he's spoken to military experts that were in Afghanistan and all other places and conflict areas. And in comparison, the steps Israel's taken to limit the loss of life, and actually, if you look at the numbers of the casualties, the losses of civilian life, it's lower than most other wars and conflicts anywhere in the world. So I think Israel's trying what they can. They have a right to defend itself. And I don't think they're going to stop until either, very simple, return the hostages, Hamas must lay down their arms, and that's at least the start of a ceasefire. Will it be the end of the war? I don't think it's that simple.
Ich fasse das nochmal zusammen. Daniel sagt, das Mandat des South African Jewish Board of Deputies bestehe darin, die Bürgerrechte der jüdischen Gemeinschaft in Südafrika zu schützen. Es gibt ca. 50.000 Juden in Südafrika. Und man setze sich nicht unbedingt für Israel ein, aber wenn jüdisches Leben beeinträchtigt wird, ist das natürlich ein Thema. Israel habe das Recht, sich als Staat und Nation zu verteidigen. 1200 unschuldige israelische Zivilisten wurden ermordet und abgeschlachtet, verbrannt, vergewaltigt. Die Liste lässt sich fortsetzen. Und Israel hat beschlossen, dass es nicht zulassen wird, dass so etwas noch einmal passiert. Die Verteidigung sei also gerechtfertigt. Daniel hat auch darüber gesprochen, dass die Hamas die Zivilbevölkerung als menschliches Schutzschilder benutzt. Und es stimmt, dass die Hamas selbst sagt, dass die Tunnel, das riesige Untergrundnetzwerk in Gazastreifen für Hamas-Kämpfer gebaut wurde, nicht für Zivilisten. Sie sehen sich nicht in der Verantwortung, ihre eigenen Bürger zu schützen. Israel versuche, den Verlust von Menschenleben zu begrenzen. Und das Land habe es vor dem IGH ja auch bewiesen, meint Daniel. Er weist darauf hin, dass den Menschen im Gazastreifen 3 Wochen Zeit gegeben wurde, um sich zu evakuieren. Es wurden Flugblätter abgeworfen, Meldungen in Arabisch veröffentlicht. Wenn man sich die Zahlen der Opfer, der Verluste am zivilen Leben anschaut, dann sei sie niedriger als bei den meisten anderen Kriegen und Konflikten in der Welt, sagt er, mit Verweis auf Militärexperten. Denn er ist sich sicher, Israel tut, was es kann, um Schaden zu begrenzen. Er betont aber immer wieder das Recht auf Selbstverteidigung. Aber genau die Art und Weise hat Südafrika dazu geführt, den Fall vor den Internationalen Gerichtshof, dem höchsten Gericht der Vereinten Nationen, zu bringen. Can you tell me a little bit more about the historical context, about the relations between South Africa and Israel?
So right now at the moment, South Africa and Israel have relations. They've always had business and economic relations. I think when we talk numbers, for example, there's something like a 10 billion rand shift in income and revenue between the two. So I think the South African government spends about 4 billion rand on importing Israeli products in a variety of fields, I think agriculture and technology and a few others. And Israel actually spends 6 billion rand in the South African economy. So if you look at the financial, South Africa definitely needs Israel more than Israel needs South Africa. And you can even see that despite South Africa's stance and pro-Palestinian stance, and the calls to cut ties, South Africa hasn't cut economic ties with Israel. The embassy hasn't even been closed, even though there was a vote in parliament a few months ago to close the embassy. That piece of paper sitting on Cyril Ramaphosa's desk, all he has to do is sign it. But there's far wider ramifications for the South African economy and South African people to simply cut ties with Israel. South Africa's always had a strong connection with the Palestinian people. If I'm not mistaken, during the apartheid era, the Palestinian people supported the ANC government. So there have been those links. And the word apartheid, I mean, you'd have to get a proper definition of it. But I think, you know, for the viewers, we all know what apartheid was in South Africa. And Israel is not an apartheid. If you have to just look at basic history, An interesting story. There was a member that's part of one of our South African Zionist Federation here, used to be a member of the BDS. And his story is that he was advocating that Israel was an apartheid state. And when he went to Israel, when he arrived at the airport, he asked the security guard, where do black people go to the bathrooms? Because during apartheid, there was a segregation of white and black. There were separate buses, there were separate benches, like during the Holocaust, where Jews had to sit on this bench and everyone else on another bench. So during apartheid, there's a lot about apartheid. I'm not an expert in apartheid, but effectively, white and black people were segregated. And the understanding is that in Israel, there's that same segregation, but there's no toilet for a black person in Israel. There's no toilet for a Palestinian person. There's just men and women, and probably might be non-binary or gender-neutral toilets at the moment. And that's where South Africans, black South Africans in particular, they look at the term apartheid, and the fact that Israel has been labeled as this apartheid state, naturally there's this emotional connection, and people don't want an apartheid to happen anywhere else in the world. Apartheid was a terrible, disgusting, abhorrent, how can I say, thing, if that's the, if I can't find a better word, that really tore the country apart, and please God, it will never ever happen again. And it's something that we have to remember and learn from. But to take the memory of apartheid and the struggles of people like Nelson Mandela and all the people that lost their lives during apartheid and just throw it around loosely and simply label now Israel as an apartheid state when it clearly isn't. We've all seen the stats on Israel and how many Palestinians are in the government and on the judicial council and are in business, etc. Certainly not an apartheid state, and it cannot be compared to the word apartheid. Problems in Israel? Sure, every country's got problems. But I think the wording apartheid is loosely used, and that's where a lot of, you might find South Africans connect with that, because what black South Africans went through during apartheid, and white South Africans actually, in terms of a lot of white South Africans, lots of Jewish people that struggled through apartheid, fighting to end apartheid.
Südafrika und Israel hätten schon immer geschäftliche und wirtschaftliche Beziehungen gehabt. Daniel unterstreicht, dass die Apartheid in Südafrika eine schreckliche, eine abscheuliche Sache war. Es habe das Land zerrissen, und er meint, das Wort Apartheid wird sehr großzügig verwendet.
South Africa just filed a case against Israel at the ICJ, the International Court of Justice, saying that Israel is committing a genocide in Gaza. And South Africa's foreign minister, Nelly de Pandor, says it's a real crime against humanity. On your website, on the website of South Africa's Jewish Board of Deputies, you're saying, and I quote this, South Africa's legal case against Israel shows the depth to which the government will sink in doing the bidding of its friends Hamas. And you're also saying, and I quote this too, South Africa continues to humiliate itself in the international arena. It has no shame in using international organizations like the International Criminal Court or the International Court of Justice when it suits their political purpose, but shuns them when it doesn't. Can you explain it to me, please?
South Africa has taken that case against Israel, but they haven't lodged any cases against Russia for genocide against Ukrainian people, or they haven't lodged any cases in Africa, in places like Sudan or in places like Myanmar. I know that's not Africa, but there are a lot of conflicts and wars taking place. You know, if I'm not mistaken, 500,000 Syrians were killed not too long ago. South Africa didn't lodge a complaint with the ICJ against Syria. There are atrocities taking place all over the world on a much larger scale. You know, when South Africa lodges a case of genocide against Israel and uses the number of 30,000, for example, there are countries around the world where there are hundreds of thousands, in fact, there are millions of people being killed and displaced and affected, where that is genocide, where the government of the time they have a mandate to rid the country of a specific group of people. I think that's the definition of genocide, is a premeditated plan to rid an entire group, religion, ethnic, race within an area. Now, you just got to look at numbers. If Israel was committing genocide, how has the population in Gaza gone from several hundred thousand in the 1940s to over 2 million 75 years later? That's the complete opposite of genocide. And like I said earlier, what Israel's been trying to do to limit the loss of life by SMSing civilians and WhatsApping and phoning and dropping pamphlets, that's, again, if they wanted to commit genocide, they could just carpet bomb the whole Gaza. and be done with it in a few minutes. So that's why we're saying South Africa is very hypocritical. I mean, we welcomed Omar Bashir, who has got an arrest warrant with the International Criminal Court. We welcomed an international killer and a perpetrator of genocide into our country, and nothing was done with it. Yet we go to the ICJ to lodge this case because the South African government's good friends Hamas asked them to nicely. That's obviously what we've meant, is that there's double standards. Our government cannot try to play the mediation role on the international stage when it feels like it. It has to be consistent, and it has not been consistent when it comes to Israel. Most definitely it has not been. It's been very hypocritical. It took a few days to condemn the October the 7th attacks by Hamas. And even then, angling that, well, it was Israel's fault that Hamas had to do this freedom fighter massacre. So that's a problem that we have with our own government. You know, we keep saying that for the South African Jewish community, there's 2 days that really shocked us. October the 7th was a huge shock, obviously. And then December the 29th, when our government lodged the complaint, we were really taken aback because now, you know, the Jewish community, you know, we've got a strong connection with Israel. And now for our own government to betray us and go and lodge this complaint, it obviously hurt our community.
Daniel zieht Vergleiche zu Russland, Sudan, Myanmar und dass Südafrika diese Länder vor dem Internationalen Gerichtshof, dem IGH, nicht verklagt habe. Er meint, dass Gräueltaten überall auf der Welt stattfinden und dass diese ein viel größeres Ausmaß haben als das, was gerade in Gaza passiere. Südafrika selbst habe im Übrigen Omar al-Bashir, den ehemaligen sudanesischen Machthaber und Diktator, empfangen, gegen den ein Haftbefehl des IGH vorliegt. Daniel spricht in diesem Zusammenhang von einem Doppelstandard seines Heimatlandes. 2 Tage seien für die afrikanisch-jüdische Gemeinschaft ein echter Schock gewesen. Der 7. Oktober und dann der 29. Dezember, als die südafrikanische Regierung vor dem IGH gezogen ist. Und Daniel spitzt seine Aussage zu. Wenn Israel wirklich einen Völkermord begehen wollte, dann wären sie in ein paar Minuten damit fertig. Er spielt auf die Warnungen und Flugblätter der IDF an. But there are South Africans who support the Palestinian people and who say that they are proud of their country and their country's actions at the ICJ. But even though the ICJ has no means of enforcing whatever they are deciding to do, it's still the first time that Israel has to defend itself in such a setting.
So I think this case was probably better for Israel because Israel had an opportunity to explain to the world what they're doing. I mean, South Africa's explanation, I'm not a lawyer, but I mean, the fact that South Africa lied in the International Court of Justice as to how they contacted Israel. I think one of the statements was they didn't receive any communication, yet Israel saying, but here's the communication to say, let's meet. And South Africa responding saying, we'll meet in January. But then on December 29th, they lodge a case with the ICJ. That's what we mean by they embarrassing themselves, because the information that they're providing is inaccurate and it's not factual. And even the way they did stuff, they lied about it at the ICJ. And to your point about South Africans are feeling proud, well, this is what we're trying to tell the international community, that it's not South Africa that stands against Israel or that supports Hamas. It's a minority. It's a minority of the ruling party. Even within the ANC, which is the national party, the ruling party, it's not the whole of the ANC. There are many members of the ANC that are God-fearing Christians as well. Many support Israel. So it's a minority. And it's a minority of pro-Palestinian supporters that support. And when I say it's a minority that support, I'd like to think everybody supports the Palestinian cause to have their own state and be free and live like human beings and not be subjected to continuous bombardment and be subjected to what's happening at the moment. But I think the minority are the radical that support Hamas, that support the terrorist organization whose mandate it is to destroy an entire country and kill Jews. And that's what we're finding in South Africa. And that's also what's upsetting, is that while Cyril Ramaphosa might have an emotional connection with the Palestinian people, I'd like to think that as a human being, he doesn't support the murder of anyone. But by supporting Hamas, he's condoning that.
Dem EuGH-Fall kann Daniel Bloch also tatsächlich etwas Positives abgewinnen. Israel habe so die Gelegenheit gehabt, der Welt zu erklären, was es tut. Und der South African Jewish Board of Deputies versuche, der internationalen Gemeinschaft zu erklären, dass es nicht Afrika ist, das sich gegen Israel stellt oder die Hamas unterstützt. Es ist eine Minderheit, sagt er. Es ist eine Minderheit in der Regierungspartei, sogar innerhalb des ANC, meint er. Den letzten Teil übersetze ich mal Wort für Wort. Zitat: Aber ich denke, die Minderheit sind die Radikalen, die die Hamas unterstützen, die eine terroristische Organisation unterstützen, deren Auftrag es ist, ein ganzes Land zu zerstören und Juden zu töten. Und das ist es auch, was uns beunruhigt. Ramaphosa mag zwar eine emotionale Verbindung zum palästinensischen Volk haben. Ich würde gerne glauben, dass er als Mensch eine Ermordung von Menschen nicht unterstützt. Aber indem er die Hamas unterstützt, duldet er das. Was denkt Daniel über die Rolle der sozialen Medien seit dem Krieg in Gaza? Und wie geht es nach der Freilassung der Geiseln in Gaza weiter? Wie können Israelis und Palästinenser in Zukunft in Frieden miteinander leben? Das erklärt er im Folgenden, spricht aber auch eine ganz klare Warnung aus.
I don't know what's going to happen if all the hostages are released. I don't think it's a simple case of will we all feel safe. The reality is that a war cannot end as long as there's a terrorist organization hell-bent on murdering innocent people. And it's the Jews today. And then if Hamas gets their way and goes through Israel and the Jewish people, well, who's next? Because their ideology is to be anyone that doesn't follow their ideology, well, is as good as dead. That's why we find it quite confusing that you've got members from the LGBTQIA plus community standing, waving Hamas flags, advocating when they're actually more, Hamas hate the LGBTQIA plus community more than they hate Jews, I think. So it's just very mind-boggling to understand how some people are supporting this organization when they themselves would be the first people killed by this group. It's quite comical, actually.
Do you have hope that Jews will ever be safe in the future?
Of course we do. And I think we keep saying, you know, people, a lot of people comparing what's happening now to the 1930s and 40s, you know, the propagandas against the Jewish community, you know, the Jews control this and we take over this. And you've seen on, I think on Instagram and TikTok, some people have walked around countries going, how many Jewish people do you think live in the country? And people are saying 1 billion, 500 million. I think there's something like 15 million Jews in the whole world. And even in this country, I think some people think that there are hundreds of thousands of Jews living just in Cape Town. There's only 13,000. Will we be safe? I'd like to think. We all have to hope that one day we can all live in peace and harmony. But the return of the hostages is not going to suddenly end the war. As we said, when we had Daniel Tapia, the former Israeli ambassador to the UK, he said, you know, when you talk about a two-state solution, which the Jewish Board of Deputies, everywhere we go, we're always advocating for peace in the Middle East, a two-state solution, a place where Israelis and Palestinians can live in peace and harmony. But he has said the problem isn't the two-state solution, the word solution. Because if you went now and you said to the Palestinians right now, you're a state, wonderful. What does that mean? Will it stop Hamas from launching rocket fire into Israel? No, it won't. So the problem here is Hamas. As long as you're going to have a terrorist organization that has an ideology to murder and kill everyone in their path, I don't think you're going to see peace anytime soon. And that's why the rest of the world needs to understand that Israel is almost the last port of call before Hamas decides to, which we know Hamas has branched off all over the world. They've got cells everywhere, as does Hezbollah and ISIS and all these other terrorist organizations. And it's only a matter of time before they start targeting the citizens from Germany, South Africa, Australia, even the Middle East countries, whether it's the UAE, Saudi Arabia, etc.
Die Frage, die ich mir stelle und die ich Daniel bitte zu beantworten, ist, was die Lösung ist. Wie kann der Krieg, der so vielen unschuldigen Menschen das Leben gekostet hat und unendlich viel Leid bedeutet, beendet werden? Und wie kann sichergestellt werden, dass so etwas nie wieder passiert?
Sure, that's a tough question. I think to start with, I think Hamas needs to return the hostages unequivocally, not an exchange for 5,000 people trapped in an Israeli prison, etc., etc. Return the hostages, lay down their weapons, all their guns, their rocket fire, open up their tunnels, and effectively for Hamas to remove itself from the Gaza Strip and to allow the Palestinians to almost have a democratic elections and try and find a leader. Now, here's the other trick. Try and find a leader that, you know, doesn't necessarily share the ideology of Hamas, that actually, as Daniel Taub mentioned, I'm sorry, I'm quoting him because he was recently here, you know, he speaks about you need to look for the builders, people that want to build up, the people that are looking to the future. What's the future of our children and our grandchildren? Hamas isn't looking to the future of anything other than what's in front of them. They're not worried about the future of any children or grandchildren. You need a leader to step up to say, what is the future going to be like for my children, my grandchildren, my great-grandchildren? And is their future hiding from rocket fire and gunfire? Or is their future building up hospitals and schools and communities and actually living life, not celebrating death, which is what Hamas does? So I think that's a start to a ceasefire and ending the war potentially. But then there's a lot more work because these terrorist organizations are all over the world. They're not just going to suddenly take a break.
Do you think that Arab countries should be more involved in building up a democracy in the Gaza Strip?
I think so. I think everybody has an interest in democracy. Everybody, who has an interest in seeing the Palestinian people live, not just have a life, but actually live. You know, it's, we take things for granted. You know, I don't think Palestinian kids are walking to school or playing in parks and on jungle gyms like our kids do, for example. So I think anybody that's committed to democracy and building life should get involved. And that's why our South African government has been so disappointing, because they claim to have the contacts with the Palestinian Liberation Organization, and clearly they have contacts with Hamas. We would have expected them to say to Hamas, what you're doing is not effective. It's doing nothing for the Palestinian people. This is what you need to do. That's what the South African government could have done. An ICJ case is a publicity stunt, and it's not going to... Israel already said, regardless of the ICJ outcome, they're not going to stop defending their civilians. So the fact that the ICJ was an embarrassment for South Africa still didn't stop Israel from continuing what they do.
Wie die Zukunft in Gaza aussehen könnte, dazu gibt es verschiedene Meinungen. In Daniels Augen sollte jeder, der Interesse an einer Demokratie hat, jeder, der ein Interesse daran hat, dass das palästinensische Volk ihr Leben leben kann, am Aufbau des Gazastreifens beteiligt sein. Auch arabische Staaten. Jeder, der sich für Demokratie und den Aufbau von Leben einsetzt, sollte sich engagieren. What gives you hope?
What gives me hope? Interesting. I write an article for the Jewish Chronicle that we have in Cape Town. It goes to our community, so every month. And my latest article that will come out, I think, in March, I speak about having faith. And the faith that hate won't win. I see that there are a lot more good people in the world. There are a lot more supporters of peace and of love, a lot more supporters of democracy. And I think also from a Jewish community perspective and from Israel, we have a lot more support, a lot more friends out there. You know, this isn't 1933, where you could say the Jews felt isolated and didn't have the support, and no one knew what was happening. That's the beauty of social media, as much as we might not like it and it's used for a lot of evil. Social media makes sure that the communication goes out and the messaging instantly. So it's not going to take weeks or months. The hope is that the sensible human being out there is going to realize what is happening, is going to realize that war isn't a solution, violence isn't a solution to anything. And we've seen that, whether it was Israel and Egypt, or whether it was the United Kingdom and Ireland, and all these countries that had these wars that lasted years, at some point they put their differences aside and they did what was best for the citizens, the people. And hopefully, you know, people will see that what is best for the Palestinian people at the moment now, it's not an ongoing war. It's not rocket fire. What's best for the Palestinian people is that there needs to be peace between whoever's in Gaza and Israel, and that they need to find a solution quickly. Otherwise, the death toll is just going to increase. So I hope that reason, rationality, and sensibility actually prevails, and that there are a lot more good people in the world that will make the right decision.
Das war eine weitere Folge unseres Fokus auf die Beziehungen Südafrikas zu Israel und dem IGH-Fall zu Gaza. Schreibt uns gerne, wie ihr die Episode findet, was ihr denkt, abonniert uns, teilt gerne auch den Podcast. Und dann hören wir uns bald wieder zu einem nächsten Teil Südafrika, Israel und dem Krieg in Gaza. Bis bald.